Well, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. On today's show, we're going to discuss the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago and Americans' entrance into World War II. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
I would like for us all to take a moment to reflect on the sacrifices made by that generation of men and women who have come to be known as the greatest generation. Historians estimate that approximately 16 million Americans participated in World War II. Of that number, almost 300,000 never returned home. Another 670,000 were wounded. And an even more sobering number is the 10 million lives that were lost in one of the saddest chapters of human history, known as the Holocaust. Almost 1,000 veterans from the greatest generation are taken from us every day. Their contributions to peace and prosperity in the world can never be forgotten. Our GIs were a shining beacon of light and hope when Europe was darkened by fascism. Names and places from that war has become part of our everyday vernacular. Eisenhower, Patton, the Bataan Death March, Normandy, Corregidor, Bastogne, Bradley, and Berlin. All of these faces and places conjure up imagery so striking that it has been ingrained upon the American psyche. Ingrained because of what the American service member did for this nation, Europe, the Pacific, and for the world. To our World War II veterans, I salute and thank you.
Thank you, General Nash. World War II went from 1939 until 1945, and the United States didn't enter the war until 1941. And joining us now in the studio is our World War II program specialist from the Minnesota Historical Society and co-host for the show today, Randall Dietrich. Randall, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio.
Good morning.
Randall, I think when we're talking about Pearl Harbor, which happened almost 75 years ago now, I think we need to set the stage and talk about 1941. The United States was coming out of a period of isolationism, and there were a lot of tensions around the world. Can you bring us up to date on what was going on?
I sure can. I mean, and give some context kind of for where that conflict came from. And, you know, looking back at it now a number of years, you could make the argument that is really a continuation of World War One, which is an argument that many historians make. And the more research I do, I'd kind of get behind that same idea that, you know, really World War One and World War Two are one related conflict, a 30 years war, if you will. If we look at the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, from there, you know, that aggression in Japan and that aggression in Germany picks up in the early 1920s. Nazism appears in 1920, early 1920s. Hitler comes to power in the early 1930s. So already things are being set in motion in large part in reply to, in response to the end of how World War One ended. So the same is true for Japan, for that matter. So in many ways, I think the conflict that we see emerging in 1939 into 1941 is really an extension of the legacy of the Great War.
And we think about World War II, we think about just those few years of war, but Hitler and Germany were upset for well over a decade, weren't they?
They were, and largely due to the war reparations, how they were treated or perceived to be treated at that Treaty of Versailles, and that really did set in motion a lot of what we dealt with the Second World War.
And so the United States, after World War One, we were kind of trying to pull back to our shores and stay here and not get involved.
Yeah, in 1939, you know, Europe is at war. 1940, Europe is at war, and there's a strong resistance for America to get involved, primarily because looking back at again that World War One experience. We see it as a changed country as a result of World War One. They didn't see any benefit or any gain, anything being gained from their fighting in the First World War. And like you said, at this point, 1939, 1940, 1941, emerging slowly, largely as a result of the military spending that was going on in support of England, primarily, things were getting better here in the United States for the first time in a long time. And so it wasn't so much that life was good and we didn't want to fight. It was like, finally, I think life was getting better. And just how good that must have felt after that those many years of the Great Depression to emerge from that with things looking brighter and then to be pulled back into the war is the last thing you want to do. And you certainly have an America First Commission, which was very active at this time. Charles Lindbergh really led that, but others, including Herbert Hoover, were also involved in really waging a campaign to keep America out of the war.
We're speaking with Randall Dietrich from the Minnesota Historical Society on Minnesota Military Radio. Now, Randall, before Japan attacked us at Pearl Harbor, they were actually at war with China, and there were a lot of things going on with Japan prior to this as well, wasn't there?
There was. There was a long series of kind of imperialism that Japan was involved in, trying to essentially create dominion in the Pacific, and that's really what motivated a lot of what they were looking for. And one of the conflicts that comes up is when they're starved for resources and we start to place embargoes on them based upon this behavior. That threat of them losing their oil supply, which 80% of it comes from the United States, is very threatening to them. And so what they have to do is make this calculation of how are they going to survive, knowing that when the United States embargoes their oil, the United States, again, provides 80% of that oil. Their reserves that they have available to fight this war in the Pacific is only enough for a year or two, so they need to make some pretty dire calculations about how they're going to survive, looking at the resources that are diminishing kind of by the month and the year.
So an island nation, and a lot of their resources came from other places.
Certainly.
And when did they get involved in fighting with China?
Yeah, the 1930s, 1937, 1939, they start making those inroads into China. And again, that's what really triggers the United States placing those embargoes on the country in 1941 is really meant, in many ways, is just a year of negotiation between the United States and Japan. I think at that time, the war is being waged in Europe. I think our attention is really in Europe, what's going on there, supporting the English, monitoring what Hitler's doing all across Europe, because a lot of these countries that, again, were born out of the legacy of World War I are the first to fall in the Second World War. And so I think our attention is there, while at the same time we're trying to have a negotiated relationship with the Japanese at that time. So I think our focus is in Europe, and we ultimately pay the price for that.
So France had fallen before Pearl Harbor happened, and leading up to December 7th, what kind of negotiations were we involved with Japan?
Yeah, negotiations really are at its height in November, is when we're negotiating back and forth about the demand essentially that we place in Japan to withdraw from China. And if they fail to do so, then again, that embargo will continue. Those negotiations really break down and break off at the end of November, November 26th, November 29th. And that's about the time that that Japanese fleet departs for the South Pacific and Hawaii. So as those negotiations break down, that fleet that's been in the making for a good year, they've been planning this eventuality. Much of 1941 is spent war planning. What does this look like? And they consider a number of different options, including invading Hawaii and maintaining an army there. But eventually then, when negotiations do break off end of November, that fleet departs. And what happens then is FDR makes a final overture to them to renew negotiations as late as December 6th. Of course, that doesn't happen. December 6th is a Saturday. Sunday morning, the attack begins. America at the time is at relative peace. There's storm clouds out there, but we're watching football. You know, we're watching college football, professional football, Sunday morning. You know, listen to it on the radio for sure, going to church, and then that news breaks.
Randall, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about what happened on the December 6th, December 7th, and we'll talk to a couple of Minnesotans that were involved in the Pearl Harbor just at the beginning of World War II. We're speaking with Randall Dietrich from the Minnesota Historical Society on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. We've been talking today with my co-host for this program, Randall Dietrich from the Minnesota Historical Society. And our topic today has been the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago, which led to America's entrance into World War II. And Randall, we were setting the stage about what was going on in the world, and the United States was somewhat isolationist. And sometime during 1941, FDR made the decision to move the Pacific Fleet to Pearl Harbor.
Out of San Diego is my recollection of it. And you know, that's kind of the first in the whole series of events and opportunities we have to combat this coming attack. And we missed that or that decision is going to weigh heavily on the attack that follows. So it's the first of its several things, several dominoes that fall that leave us so vulnerable. And some of those other dominoes are missing the signals and advance warnings that we do receive.
Now, Randall, we've interviewed a couple of Minnesotans that were involved in Pearl Harbor, and one of them is a gentleman named Richard Thill. And as the United States was getting ready for a possible war, a previously decommissioned ship, the USS Ward, was brought back into active service. She recommissioned in January 1941 and was sent to Pearl Harbor shortly thereafter. The destroyer operated on local patrol duties in Hawaiian waters over the next year, and among the crew of 84 Minnesota Naval Reservists, including 17-year-old Richard Thill. And here's a clip we recorded with him a couple of years ago.
When I was just 17, I was in the Naval Reserve down in St. Paul here, and I went on the cruise on the Great Lakes. And then, of course, when we got back off the Great Lakes cruise in August, we were told by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, now you're going to be gone for a year on a national emergency problem, and we were going to take you on in January because we didn't want to take you before Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's and all that. So they waited until around January 21st, and we all, 84 of us, there were 84 Naval Reservists, enlisted men, and two officers, and went down to San Diego. And that's where we caught the and recommissioned, actually, the USS Ward in around February of 1941.
So all of you were assigned to the Ward, sir?
Yes. There was the 47th Division, Naval Reserve of St. Paul. And we were all, some of us had to leave high school in our junior year. I think there were four from Humboldt High School, and there I think there were about five from Johnson High School that had to leave high school and go on active duty.
And the Ward was shipped off to Pearl Harbor.
Yes, we went right down to Pearl Harbor. We got down there around March 9th, and we were assigned to the 80th Destroyer Division in the Naval in the Hawaiian Sea Frontier, because, you know, Hawaii was not a state yet.
Sir, what did you think when you realized the fleet was coming under attack by the Japanese?
Well, we really didn't. They were said before, it was all chaos. Nobody really knew what was happening. And we found this little submarine was in our restricted sea area. See, just outside of Pearl Harbor, there's this 2-square-mile restricted sea area, and that's where the 80th Destroyer Division would patrol that area, one of our ships at a time for a week. And, of course, anything that showed up in that area was a fair target, even peacetime. But the thing was discovered, and when they did see it, didn't know who it was. The thing is a midget submarine. I don't know if people don't know what a midget submarine is, but it's actually 80 feet long, carries two full-size torpedoes and a crew of two, and it only has a diameter of about six feet.
You actually sank that before the attack, sir?
Pardon?
You actually sank that before the attack started?
Oh, yes, about an hour before the attack started.
And then did the Ward stay outside the harbor and try to defend the entrance, or what did you do?
Well, we had no idea what we had done, really. We didn't know who it was, and nobody seemed to know. There were no markings on it, no numbers, and no names or anything. And there was a PBY plane flying above by Lieutenant Ensign Tanner, and he had just patrolled the island, and he saw it down there, and I think he thought it was, the way he said later, he thought it might be one of our submarines in some kind of trouble, because submarines were not allowed to be submerged when they went in and out of that area. And so he dropped a smoke bomb down there to help us locate it. Well, we already knew where it was. But I think he was very surprised when we went over there and shot at it. I think he dropped a couple of depth bombs on it too. So I don't know, it did any harm because the thing was pretty close to the surface. And it was by the time we shot at it, it was only probably about 150, 200 feet away from us. And so it was very close.
That was Richard Thill, a Minnesota native who was aboard the USS Ward that sank a Japanese mini-sub about 1 hour prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor. A gun from the Ward can be seen at the Minnesota State Capitol grounds. 3 years to the day after a number one gun fired the opening shot of America's involvement in the war, the USS Ward was patrolling off the invasion area in Leyte and when she came under attack by several Japanese kamikazes. One bomber hit her hull amidships, bringing her to a dead stop. When the resulting fires could not be controlled, Ward's crew was ordered to abandon ship, and she was sunk by gunfire from the O'Brien, whose commanding officer, William Outerbridge, had been in command of the Ward during her action off Pearl Harbor 3 years ago. Randall, I'm thinking Richard Thill was 17 years old, went out to San Diego, signed to the USS Ward, and his duty was to go to Hawaii.
Yeah.
He must have thought he was going to heaven.
He and a lot of other folks thought they were going to heaven. I mean, it's, you know, 1941, there's storm clouds out there, but for those service people that were in Hawaii at the time, I think a lot of them were thinking they were as far away from the action as they could possibly get, and Hawaii is a long ways from Europe, and that's where we thought, you know, for the most part, a war would be starting for us, and of course, that wasn't the case.
Well, the world was kind of a mess with Germany and Italy and Japan all kind of acting up,
and
I'm sure there were some security concerns in the fall of 1941.
There were, and, you know, even looking at the attack itself, there were certainly advisors that were suggesting the possibility of a Japanese attack, but those advisors were not suggesting for the most part that Hawaii would be the target of that attack. Something closer to Japan was much more in line with the Philippines and the like. So lots of folks were surprised when Pearl was attacked December 7th, including Richard, who does talk about that chaos that did ensue for a good 2 hours and, you know, for much longer, but the attack was a 2 hour in duration. And there was warnings that were issued. Commander Martin on November 29th, which is a date we talked about earlier, you know, tells his troops in Hawaii that, we're on essentially a war footing. But I think how he and others read those advisories that were coming his way was that the threat was from within. About 40% of folks in Hawaii were of Japanese descent, and they were concerned at the time about espionage taking place. And so that was, I think, what motivated them to do what they did in some cases, concentrating the warships, concentrating the airplanes to make it easier to monitor them and also keep it further away from the population that might be inclined to do some sort of act of terrorism or espionage or sabotage, for that matter, to jeopardize the fleet. But I think the threat they foresaw was a threat from the island, not a threat from six aircraft carriers from Japan descending upon the island.
So they were concerned that there might be some terrorists or somebody else on the island that might try to approach the ships or the aircraft with bombs.
Yes.
And so they clustered them together so that they could guard them more easily?
Well, that's one approach. And, of course, that approach prevents one thing from happening, but it also lines up beautifully if you're about to launch an air raid with 300 aircraft from Japan and you come in down through the cloud cover and see all these airplanes and battleships all clustered together, that's an easy target.
And it's what they called in Hawaii battleship row.
Battleship row.
The battleships were actually side by side and all lined up from end to end.
Yeah, six of them.
And as you say, if I'm an aviator and I want to drop some torpedoes or some bombs, what better situation?
Yeah, you hit one and you end up hitting the one next door to it as well, and that's a pretty good return. Tragic.
Well, we know how that turned out. So, Randall, just getting back to the Ward for a minute, can you tell us what came of the Ward action that morning, the December 7th, and what followed?
Yeah, well, you know, again, keep in mind, it is a World War One destroyer, and what these guys are doing on a World War One ship, you know, at the beginning of World War II, it's a fascinating story, and it's a pretty good shot. The second shot they took, you know, hit that, you know, Japanese mini sub, sinking it. And that, as Richard mentioned in the clip, you know, is a good hour before the air raid actually begins. And so there's a series of warnings that come the way of the command. One of them is the report that's issued by Outerbridge that they fired on and supposedly sunk a Japanese sub. There's another another radar station that detects the air raid incoming. And so again, that's another warning that's issued. But again, this is Sunday morning, a sleepy Sunday morning after You know, the servicemen have been out the night before, and as Richard identifies in his clip, you know, the attack happens and nobody knows what's going on. And the last thing they're thinking in some ways is the Japanese, but that becomes very apparent that it is shortly after the bombs start to burst.
Now, there were several unlucky things, like putting the Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor, but the one lucky thing that happened was our aircraft carriers were out to sea.
They missed the aircraft carriers, an essential part of how we came back and, you know, beat them at Midway and other places after 6 months after the attack at Pearl. So that's a key thing that did work in our favor was, one, that, and then two, you know, sparing really the oil supply that we were so dependent upon in Hawaii, and then sparing the dry docks where we made a lot of repairs to these battleships after the attack concluded.
Randall, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the actual morning of the attack at Pearl Harbor 75 years ago. My co-host today is Randall Dietrich from the Minnesota Historical Society. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, along with my co-host for the day, Randall Dietrich from the Minnesota Historical Society, and we're talking about Pearl Harbor at plus 75 years, and we're going to get back to that in just a moment. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Shelito.
December 7, 1941, a date that will live in infamy. Each and every day I'm reminded of the sacrifices our Pearl Harbor veterans made as I see the 50 caliber gun from the USS Ward that sits just west of the Veterans Service Building here in St. Paul. We honor and remember our heroes who are with us today and those who have passed. Thank you for tuning in to this special show today. It's an honor to serve our veterans.
Thank you, Commissioner Shelito. We want to introduce another Minnesotan who was involved in Pearl Harbor 75 years ago today. And a few years ago, we talked to retired Colonel Ed Nakasone, who served with the United States Army Reserves most of his career and is a retired history professor at Century College in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. He was just a young Japanese-American boy of 14 on December 7, 1941, and was living with his family in Oahu, just a few miles from the main Army base, Schofield Barracks. Now here's a short clip of our interview with Colonel Nakasone. Colonel, you were born and raised in Hawaii, and you were a second-generation Japanese-American called Nisei?
Hai, that's right.
Hai. And what were you doing on December 7th, 1941, around breakfast time?
Well, interestingly, of course, I was all time very interested in the world affairs, reading newspapers, listening to radio, plus the fact that my father was just returning from Japan. In fact, 1 month before Pearl Harbor, he returned to Hawaii. We were very concerned about that. So I was extremely interested in what was going on in the negotiations in Washington, D.C., the Hull, Kurusu, and Nomura affair going on at that time. And so I was there and listening, and I was having brereakfast one day. That was December 7th, 1941. Looking westward towards the mountains, and here I see beautiful formation of planes coming through Kolokolo Pass, and after that, going in down and attacking Schofield Barracks. They did not drop any bombs in Schofield Barracks. Then they zoomed up again, and like another beautiful formation came swooping down Wheeler Army Airfield there and started dropping bombs. And what happened is that they had the bombs fall directly upon the planes, and saw the planes go up. I saw the tarmac going up. I saw the hangars going up. I saw all kinds of fire, all kinds of noise coming from there. We were no more than 3 miles in the Heights area in the town of Waihewa. And so that's how Pearl Harbor greeted me. And I looked over towards Pearl Harbor, 14 miles to the east, and here the big boom, 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 black ACAC fires. Now later on, a plane comes zooming over my home. I see the great big round ball of red ball underneath the plane's wings and on the fuselage, and I ran into the house and said, wake up, everybody, Japan is attacking us. And then I turned on the radio, and radio was saying, all servicemen return to your bases, the Japanese are attacking the service people of Hawaii. And so with this war greeted us, and then I knew exactly that the war was with us. I saw a plane up there, but a plane came through, and it had the cockpit open and the scarf flowing out, and I saw the goggles on the pilot. I saw this pilot. He was no more than 250 feet up in the air, And in fact, my neighbor yelled and waved at him. I said, no, he's not our friend, and so on. Well, anyway, when he turned out, war greeted us in that fashion. And then that night we had blackout, and all those things became. And then following day, I was already digging a bomb shelter under my direction of my father. And this is the way war greeted us. It was, I could see all kinds of planes, dogfighting up in the area, over Schofield Barracks and over towards Eva Army Airfield, Pearl Harbor, and so on. So it was quite a tragic era as far as I'm concerned. It's now 70 years ago that this has happened.
Colonel, it sounds like you can remember that just like it was yesterday, but the attack was only a couple hours, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. But they started at 7:55, and then by 10:30, almost everything was over. So this is the way it was. There are many interesting stories about what went on during that day, but it's some that will probably take a little bit more research to find out exactly what happened to some of these people.
Tuff still going. He's up to the 25, and now he's hit and hit hard about the 27-yard line. Bruiser Kennard made the tackle.
We interrupt this broadcast and bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands man your battle station.
We have witnessed this morning a distant view, a great battle off Pearl Harbor, and a severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by enemy planes, undoubtedly Japanese. The city of Honolulu has also been attacked. Considerable damage done. This battle has been going on for nearly 3 hours.
Randall, 75 years ago on a Sunday morning, people were going to church, watching football in Hawaii. They were probably just recovering from a great Saturday night in Honolulu or whatever they were doing. Must have been just shock in Hawaii and here in Minnesota and all over the world.
It was, and the tragic loss that follows that two-hour attack is 2,403 service members killed in the attack, and it devastates the Navy in many ways, but also at the same time, as you had mentioned, the carriers were not in the harbor during the attack, and that gives us the ability to pick ourselves up, brush ourselves off, and pick up the fight.
And we'd never been in a fight like this before. World War One was a big battle, but the attack on Pearl Harbor was the thing that set the United States on a course with war with Japan. And shortly after that, then Germany and Italy declared war on us, and we declared war right back. And wow, the people of Hawaii and Minnesota, everywhere, all over the country, had to be just in shock, saying, "What? How in the world did we get here?"
Yeah, I mean, the attack is December 7th. Germany declares war on us, making it a two-front war on December 11th, and all of a sudden, you know, we're engaged in what is now a global fight. And at that same time, and we're trying to grasp that on a national perspective, but you can appreciate folks like, you know, Richard Thill's parents, you know, wondering what's become of their son. So you have a very global story and at the same time a very, very personal story with family members who have servicemen and women in Hawaii wondering what the outcome of that is. You know, as I mentioned, 2,400 killed in action on that day. You have 1,177, you know, that die in the Arizona and others that are stuck in the West Virginia and die in the West Virginia because they can't be, you know, rescued essentially. So the cost that we paid on that morning was a very, very high cost.
Randall, from the Japanese perspective, was it worth the risk?
Well, they were going for that knockout punch. This is the one shot that they had, given their limited resources, to you know, knock the U.S. Navy and at least the Pacific Fleet out of the war for a good period of time. They didn't get everything they were looking for, I would argue, in their attack at Pearl Harbor. They did wake that sleeping giant that they had been warned about, and as a result, you know, we did pick ourselves up and got back in the fight. And to answer your question, it wasn't worth it because they didn't finish the job, and we went back and the tide turned in Midway in June of 1942. The Doolittle raid helped psychologically here at home, and the rest is history.
And as we now know, they woke a sleeping economic giant, didn't they?
They did.
The combined resources of the United States of America to produce aircraft and ships and tanks and machine guns and ammunition before this date, nobody knew how much that we could do, did they?
We didn't know. We did become that arsenal of democracy and won the battle on both fronts.
We're speaking with Randall Dietrich from the Minnesota Historical Society about Pearl Harbor plus 75 years. We have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear from FDR on his famous speech on December 8th, 1941. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense. but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us.
That was President Franklin D. Roosevelt's speech on December 8, 1941, in reaction to the bombing of Pearl Harbor by the Japanese in 75 years ago. And, of course, it prompted America's entrance into World War II. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. My co-host today has been Randall Dietrich from the Minnesota Historical Society. And, Randall, after that famous speech I think everybody's heard, how long did it take Congress to declare war?
It didn't take them long at all. In fact, they took it an almost immediate vote, and it was nearly unanimous. It was 388-1. So that's a declaration of war to go after Japan for all the things that FDR just delineated in his speech.
And that was December 8th, 1941. And 2 days later, Germany and Italy declared war on the United States. And, of course, Germany, Italy, and Japan were referred to as the Axis.
The Axis. And then in Japan joins that Axis League, I believe, back in 1940. So we see some of this coming together, but in early December 1941, it all becomes very, very real.
So the people of the United States have to be shocked, and they've been shocked out of this staying home and staying out of conflict, and now they know they're in it and they're involved within a very short period of time. What was going on? Were the recruiters pretty busy?
Yeah, there weren't too many football games played after that, I don't think. An awful lot of folks signed up the next morning. You know, they were there ready to enlist that next day in mass, and overwhelming the offices that were going to receive them, for that matter. So you have an immediate outpouring of people volunteering to join the fight, essentially, that really did overwhelm the offices. At the same time, you have other things going on across the country, because this was a nationwide effort, and that nationwide effort requires sacrifice. And some of those sacrifices are immediately conversations start about rationing. And how do we ration? What is each person's role in that rationing? Blackouts happen at night in order to protect against night raids and bombings, for that matter. Curfews are put into effect. And another thing that does happen almost immediately is sadly, you know, Japanese Americans start to be rounded up in response to what did happen at Pearl Harbor. So it's a mixed bag.
Wasn't there some fear that California was going to be attacked next?
That was a fear that was had. I mean, that was definitely a fear. There's fear here in the Twin Cities, for that matter. They made the case that an airplane flight from Tokyo to Minneapolis is shorter than it is from Tokyo to San Francisco. So even here in the Midwest, in the Twin Cities and across the state of Minnesota, we believe that we were insulated. But there was a strong effort to convince the population otherwise. We were at risk here in Minnesota.
So meanwhile, when Congress is declaring war on Japan, and Germany and Italy did it to us and we did it back to them, back in Hawaii, We're trying to assess the damage, clean up the mess, find the men, find all of the casualties. But we found some good news, because the Japanese didn't come with the third wave, and we saved our sub pens, we saved our tank farms with all the fuel, which we needed desperately, and they didn't attack our repair facilities. So that allowed us to pick up a little quicker than we might have otherwise.
They weren't able to finish the job. They certainly caught us by surprise. But again, that quick response, for those reasons you just identified, you know, did help us to return back to the fight quicker than without those things. It would have been a much tougher road without it. And as we mentioned earlier, you know, you've got a number of setbacks that happened immediately after that. But then, you know, Midway happens, you know, in June of 1942. Midway is really represents kind of a turning point in the naval campaign in the Pacific, where the United States starts to turn the tables on Japan. You've got the Doolittle Raid, I believe, in April of 1942, just before that, which doesn't do a lot of damage in Japan, in Tokyo, but what it does do is it provides a tremendous psychological lift and really communicates to the public here that they're all involved in some way. And what it communicates is that we can deliver that same blow to their mainland as they did to Hawaii.
We're speaking with Randall Dietrich from the Minnesota Historical Society and Minnesota Military Radio, talking about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago, which caused America's entrance into World War II. So Randall, back at FDR's desk, he's now got a war on two fronts, a war in the Pacific and a war in Europe. He's got American citizens all over the country signing up that want to get into this thing, and let's get after it. And he probably doesn't have – any of the equipment that he needs, although we had been gearing up for equipment for some time, hadn't we?
We had. I mean, that was part of the reason that we were able to come out of that Great Depression in the late 1930s, and things were looking good in 1941. So in some ways, we had made plans and had made preparations. But then, you know, FDR needs to make the decision about, you know, where to direct our forces first, and that decision really was in the Pacific with Midway and the like.
So the Pacific became an aircraft carrier war, and we refloated some of the battleships, but specifically Midway was an aircraft carrier battle, and we were lucky enough to win that. And then the war in Europe was Army and Air Force.
It was. And you know, even FDR mentions it in his announcement that, you know, the Philippines are attacked. And, you know, here in Minnesota, you've got 62 residents from Brainerd who are part of that 194th Tank Battalion, and they're in the Philippines. And so, again, you have parents here in Brainerd wondering what's become of their sons who are part of that tank battalion in the Philippines.
Randall, there's so much to cover, and we're just about out of time, but I know you're going to do a lot more on Pearl Harbor on the 75th anniversary.
Wednesday, December 7th, coming up this week. We absolutely are partnering with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the Fort Snelling Rifle Squad, and a lot of other groups. We're hosting a series of programs all day long at the History Center, starting at 10 o'clock that morning. The History Center in St. Paul. There's a commemorative program at 10 a.m. There's other lectures happening at 1 o'clock and 3:30 in partnership with the World War II Roundtable, the Harold C. Deutsch Roundtable. And that evening, Dave Kenny, who's author of a book, Minnesota Goes to War, is speaking at 7 o'clock. And that does include also a tribute to General John Vesey, who we lost this past year as well. So it's a full day of programming. We invite the public to join us on that day, on Wednesday. And remember Pearl Harbor.
Randall, we just got about a minute left. Any final thoughts on Pearl Harbor plus 75 years?
75 years. You know, if anything good can be taken from the tremendous loss that it was, you know, it may have demonstrated to everyone in this country what we're capable of doing when the call to action is so very, very clear. And the kinds of things that we did together as a unified country is not something that we've seen since. And I think that's a real legacy of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And that's why we remember Pearl Harbor for those that served and sacrificed on that day, and also the tremendous work that the country put in after that attack.
And the combined economic output of the United States of America was really something to be seen in World War II. And as you said, we were woken up at Pearl Harbor. The last time something like that happened was September 11, 2001, and we all pulled together for a while. So I think we need to remember we're capable of doing it. We're all Americans. Let's get out there and take care of this great country.
Yes.
Randall, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're just about out of time. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Randall Dietrich, Richard Thill, Ed Nakasone, Commissioner Larry Shelleteau of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next weekend on this station or online anytime at minnesotamilitaryradio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
Minnesota Military Radio is a production of iHeartMedia, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the Minneapolis VA, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, and the Minnesota National Guard. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phelan Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is a life member of the American Legion, VFW, Vietnam Veterans of America, and the DAV. For podcasts and the latest updates, follow us at Minnesota. Go to militaryradio.com.